The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Maybe they don't want the country to go into an economic panic or markets to drop. Maybe they think that some foreign adversaries will take advantage of the situation if they know that the president is weak. Sometimes it's just a crass political calculation that they don't want to appear to be weak. Whatever the reasoning, more often than not, White Houses do not give out accurate and timely information about the president's medical condition in a case like this.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 5th, 2020. President Trump, as you've all heard, is at Walter Reed with the COVID virus. A large number of executive branch and legislative branch officials have also tested positive for the virus. What happens when the president is seriously ill? What happens when the president is incapacitated? And what happens when a presidential candidate, after people are already voting, falls seriously ill? These are not all questions entirely answered by the law, but they are all questions on which the law has something to say. And we thought we would get a Lawfare panel together to chew it all over. Quinta Jurecic is the managing editor of Lawfare. Jack Goldsmith is a founding editor of Lawfare. And David Priest is Lawfare's chief operating officer and, by coincidence, a historian of circumstances in which presidents get removed from office, including but not limited to debilitating illness and death. Welcome, everybody. It's the Lawfare Podcast. October 5th, the president and the coronavirus. All right, Quinta, let's start with you. What is the current lay of the land? We're recording at 2 in the afternoon on Sunday. What do we know?
I think the correct answer to the question of what we know is not a lot, frankly. In broad strokes, just to remind everyone where we are. In the very early hours of Friday, President Trump tweeted that he had tested positive for the coronavirus. On Friday afternoon, he was flown on Marine One to Walter Reed Medical Center in what the White House initially said was a precautionary measure. We have been getting updates from the medical team, including his the head doctor, Dr. Sean Conley, Saturday and Sunday. And I think it is fair to say that those updates from Dr. Conley have been somewhat confused. On Saturday, Conley gave a very rosy statement about Trump's progress, said he was doing well. Essentially, immediately following that press conference, the White House press pool reported that an unnamed senior staffer had told them that Trump's condition was potentially serious, potentially much, much worse than Dr. Conley had expressed. It soon came out that it appears that that anonymous staffer was actually White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who was caught on camera telling a bunch of pool reporters that he wanted to take them aside and give them some information off the record. And there was quickly a lot of confusion because of the timeline that Dr. Conley put out. He initially said that Trump was 72 hours into the diagnosis, which would have put him sick around sometime Wednesday. Quickly then, the White House released a flurry of letters saying that Conley had actually misspoken and he was less than 72 hours in. So that, I think, sort of set the confused tone. Midday Sunday, Dr. Conley gave another update. He did say that the president had continued to improve, that he had received some supplementary oxygen, but his oxygen levels were currently over 95%, I believe. And he did say that they had not fallen into the low 80s. So there's a range there. And it's not clear where Trump was. Dr. Conley also said that Trump had been receiving the steroid dexamethasone. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, which was, I think, interesting to a lot of doctors watching the press conference, insofar as dexamethasone is actually a steroid that you would not administer to someone who was not on ventilation or on oxygen. It's something that actually, if you administer to a patient who's not receiving oxygen by some means, the outcome tends to be worse. So it's a little unclear what to make of that. Perhaps the doctors are just treating Trump very aggressively because, of course, he is the president. Perhaps the picture is a little less rosy than the doctor indicated. But with all that on the table, Dr. Conley did, you know, say that the president was doing better and that they're hoping to release him from Walter Reed on Monday, at which point he'd be cared for in the White House.
All right. So this puts a lot of different questions on the table. And just to be clear, we are not going to touch any of the political questions because that's not really what we do. So the most immediate question here, and there's no way to talk about this without being morbid. So with apologies, I'm just going to be morbid. Let's start, Jack, with the easy question. What happens if the president dies or becomes incapacitated?
If he dies or becomes incapacitated, the vice president acts as president. That's specified in the Constitution itself.
And to be clear, if he dies, the vice president becomes president, right? Whereas if he becomes incapacitated, the 25th Amendment allows the vice president to take over on an acting basis. Is that?
So the succession clause in Article 2 says that in the case of the removal of the president from office or his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the office, the same, meaning the powers and duties of the office, shall devolve on the vice president. And the 25th Amendment specifies the procedures whereby you can make those determinations.
And basically, let's walk through that for those who are not, who think the 25th Amendment is about presidential mental illness, which a lot of people do these days. Actually, the 25th Amendment is about exactly this circumstance, right?
Yes. It says if the president, a couple of procedural circumstances, but if the president transmits notice to the president pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of the office, and until he transmits a declaration to the contrary, those powers and duties shall be discharged by the vice president. And it also specifies a circumstance where the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can affect the same outcome, but then there's a process for determining ultimately who is president or vice president.
Right. So when people have talked about the 25th Amendment generally in the Trump administration, they've generally talked about it in terms of Section 4, which is this, you know, the cabinet and Congress can act without the president's involvement. But it seems to me the most relevant section here is Section 3, where the president can kind of voluntarily turn things over to the vice president, as presidents have in the past. I think numerous presidents have had colonoscopies and or minor medical procedures and, you know, said, hey, the vice president's in charge for a few hours. You know, unless you imagine that Trump were to suddenly slip into unconsciousness and be unable to effectuate the provisions himself, the 25th Amendment's use here would likely be a voluntary transfer while he's in bad shape. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I mean, we're abstracting away from who the president is. I actually have a hard time. I mean, who knows, but I have a hard time imagining Trump doing that unless. But yes, in theory, you're right. It's Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, which contemplates the president himself sort of transferring temporary authority to the vice president. That's probably an issue here. But as you say, if he were suddenly to be in very bad shape and unable to discharge the duties of the office, then the next section would kick in.
Ben, let me jump in to add to that, that we should be really grateful for the 25th Amendment because it actually clarifies all three potential situations. In the case of the president dying, its first section actually makes more clear than the original Constitution what happens. It states clearly, the vice president shall become president. It clarifies what happens if the president wants to temporarily transfer power in Section 3, because before there was no means by which the president would then become president again. It was merely that the vice president would take over. Now it indicates that the president can temporarily declare himself disabled and then take back the powers and duties of the office from the acting president, who would have been the vice president. And then, of course, Section 4 provides the mechanism by which the vice president and half of the cabinet or more, not Congress, can declare the president unfit. But the president can appeal that. And if either the vice president or half of the cabinet or more than one third of either house of Congress agrees with the president can take back the powers and duties of the office at that time. So the 25th Amendment does a really good job of helping us, certainly from before 1967.
Yeah, so that's a great point, and it's one that I want to come back to in a minute, because there is actually some work that the 25th Amendment doesn't do, which is, although I totally agree with you, it's doing a huge amount of work here, and prior to its ratification, there would be a lot more questions than there are now. That said, there's a really important piece of work it doesn't do, which is the election law work, right, of what happens before the election and after the election if there's uncertainty as to the president's, the nominees, who happens to be the president's health, and he's already on the ballot. But let's return to that question in a moment, because David, I want you to address, you know, Quinta has given us this rather tortured White House response. You wrote a piece in Lawfare and in a shorter version in the Washington Post the other day that basically says, you know, the history of this sort of health crisis in the White House is in fact a history of tortured responses. There are a lot of times that we've said, you know, Donald Trump is shattering norms. But one thing I was thinking as I was listening to Quinto was, boy, this sounds right in line with David Priest's history of this stuff. So my question is Donald Trump faithfully observing presidential norms of deception and hiding things with respect to presidential health?
It's odd, isn't it? He's actually not shattering a norm here. He's following one. Unfortunately, it's a quite negative norm of presidents and those around presidents, at best, limiting their knowledge that gets to the public about severe health issues, and at worst, outright lying about them. And what we've seen the last 2 days, Quinta's summary of Dr. Conley's remarks, certainly indicate that. There's at best confusion and a lack of clarity, and at worst, active deception going on. Ironically, before I get to the history, the one sentence that the doctor is getting the most heat over from the Sunday press conference, he said, "I didn't want to give any information that might steer the illness in another direction." He's getting dunked on for that because of this idea that he's talking about magical thinking, that, you know, saying something about the virus will make the virus react. But in fact, this might be the most forthright thing he said. Because if he was out there in the press conference saying things that Donald Trump had told him not to say, then Donald Trump might simply storm out of the hospital, not follow any of the medical advice that he's been following, and that in fact would lead the illness to go in another direction. So I give the doctor a minimal amount of credit for that. He's not as bad as Dr. Kerry Grayson, who was Woodrow Wilson's physician, who conspired with Edith Wilson, the president's spouse, to basically keep the condition of Woodrow Wilson after a major stroke hidden, not only from the people, not only from the media, not only from Congress, but also from his own administration. People didn't know how bad the president was, and he was in very bad condition for many weeks, and in fact, over the rest of his presidency, never fully recovered. And there was no real political hit for it. In fact, people were still trying to recruit Wilson to run for a third term in 1920. So the norm that has been established over time is presidents, using varying reasonings, will not reveal full information about something that could be perceived as negative about the president's health. Maybe they don't want the country to go into an economic panic or markets to drop. Maybe they think that some foreign adversaries will take advantage of the situation if they know that the president is weak. Sometimes it's just a crass political calculation that they don't want to appear to be weak. Whatever the reasoning, more often than not, White Houses do not give out accurate and timely information about the president's medical condition in a case like this.
David, is that just a historic presidency thing? My impression is that modern presidents have been much more forthcoming with health information, and that we do have, you know, jokes aside, something of a modern norm of presidential candor about their health, although there are certainly exceptions to that, like John F. Kennedy's apparent drug addictions. And it does seem like Trump's behavior is more consistent with the non-modern presidency than with the modern presidency, no?
I think that's fair. The trend line has been positive with some speed bumps along the way. And in both the Post and the Lawfare articles, I did not write about John F. Kennedy because that is so difficult to unpack in anything shorter than a dissertation. But most of the modern presidents have done better. Some aberrations, Richard Nixon had some conditions, possibly including drunkenness, that were not being revealed at crucial times, and certainly some depression at the end of his presidency. The situation with Ronald Reagan on the day he was shot in April 1981 was one of general confusion at the White House and at the hospital about his condition, so they could be excused for not being completely forthcoming. But even then, they certainly made some mistakes and were not giving all the information they had when they had it. But other than that, and especially with the presidents since then, things like the announcement of President George H.W. Bush having Graves' disease, and instances where presidents went in for surgery, including anesthesia, and used Section 3 of the 25th Amendment to temporarily transfer power to the vice president. In these cases, in recent decades, presidents have generally done better. But you can go back to the beginning of the Republic and find cases of presidents behaving badly and not giving full reports of information. And Trump certainly seems to be reverting back to the long-term norm.
So, David, with the caveat that among your many skills, you are not an election law guy, this is now about Trump in his capacity, not as president, but as the Republican nominee for president. What happens if, you know, ballots have already been printed, 3.2 million people have already voted, what happens if the presidential candidate of a major party is seriously ill or, you know, God forbid, dead at the time the votes are counted, or in the period between the counting of the votes if he were to win, say, and Inauguration Day?
This is fun in a perverse way, Ben, because it takes me back to grad school and my political science hat comes back on. And I remember talking about these scenarios in hypotheticals, and then, of course, researching some of them for the history of how presidents have left office or could leave office. But thankfully, we had in Lawfare on Sunday, Brian Kalt from Michigan State University wrote an article laying out many of these scenarios. So we're actually in the worst possible zone for a president to be removed from a ballot or to have a change to the election. If it's earlier in the summer, then even after the conventions, the party rules of the two major parties do allow them to change the candidate. They have different means for doing so, different mechanisms within the party, But both the Republicans and the Democrats can change their candidate, citing the death of the candidate, the disability of the candidate. And then I think in the Democratic case, it's a disability. In the Republican case, they cite the word otherwise, leaving it a little more open. But they have to have a cause for doing it. And then a mechanism kicks in for a smaller group of party leaders to decide who will be the candidate. If it's much later in the process, such as after the Electoral College has met or after the election, there are means for actually dealing with that. But right now, it's really hard because even if the party were to say, and I think it's unlikely, let's put that out there, but if the Republican Party were to say, we don't like the trend line of his medical prognosis and he's not willing to step aside, we are going to use that rule and remove him from the ballot. Well, it's not really up to them. It's up to the states. And so many states have already printed ballots. So many states have already mailed out ballots. So many states have already started early voting that it's still happening. He makes the point it's practically impossible to pull a candidate at this point. At some level, it doesn't matter because you're not really electing the candidate. You're electing electors. Then it goes to the state rules for what electors can and cannot do in different contingencies. And that varies as well. Either way, it would open up a Pandora's box of contradicting claims, potential lawsuits, court cases. It would be a real mess to have anything along those lines going on now.
And just to be clear, if he were to, you know, you have the election with him in the hospital, and then he were to die, he wins, and then he were to die, that's a solvable problem because the electors then just vote for the vice presidential candidate, who then also becomes president in his other capacity. Is that fair?
Almost certainly. If it happens after the Electoral College has met, and let's say that Trump and Pence win the election in the Electoral College, and then Trump dies, as of now, the rules all say that Pence will become president on Inauguration Day, and then under the terms of the 25th Amendment, he would immediately, or as soon as possible, nominate a vice president who would then be approved by the mechanism laid out in the 25th Amendment for a new vice president to fill that vacancy. If instead the president were to die after the election, but before the Electoral College meets, I think it stands to reason that electors would see votes for the Trump-Pence ticket as the reason to continue to vote for the Trump-Pence ticket, but Trump obviously would be unable to take office and it would be Pence. This is where the intricacies of various state laws and regulations come in, especially given the recent court case talking about faithless electors and whether electors can vote for somebody who is not who they are bound to vote for by the results of the state election. It gets a little bit trickier, but to your point, yes, the most likely scenario is that if Trump and Pence were to win the election in the Electoral College, either before or after the Electoral College initiated their formal vote, it probably would lead to a Pence presidency.
All right. So now, Jack, this brings us to the subject of your unnervingly prescient article from a few months ago, I guess over the summer.
It was actually in March.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Time is not moving normally. Back then, you wrote a piece about what happens if both Trump and Pence were to get the coronavirus and there was a double succession crisis. This is, I think, a suddenly very realistic scenario. Today on one of the Sunday talk shows, the Trump campaign official being interviewed made a point of saying that Pence would go back out on the campaign trail this week and was going to be out in public. So you have one of the two of them who's already in the hospital, and the other of whom who is presumably going to be taking, one would hope, more precautions than they have been taking so far, but is not going to be holed up in the vice presidential mansion or in the old executive office building, being very insulated from the coronavirus. So let's spin out the morbid fantasy. what happens if Mike Pence were to contract the coronavirus and both the president and the vice president were to become incapacitated or to expire as a result of it?
Right. So it's complicated. I'll tell you first what the written law says, and then I'll tell you what the problems with the written law are. The succession statute in the Constitution in Article 2 provides that Congress can, by law, declare who shall effectively the exact term is act as president if both the president and the vice president die or become incapacitated. And Congress, in its most recent effort at this in 1947, specified, and there are lots of shows written around this premise, specified that the next in line in succession is the Speaker of the House and then the President Pro Tem of the Senate. And so the first cut answer is that Nancy Pelosi would act as president. She would, under the succession statute of 1947, have to resign as Speaker of the House and as representative in Congress. That's probably because there's something called the incompatibility clause in the Constitution, which says that basically a member of Congress cannot serve in the executive branch. But that is the way that the law as written contemplates what would happen. Basically, the Speaker of the House, under the succession statute, pursuant to the constitutional succession provision, would act as President of the United States. The problem is that there are a lot of people, I would say the majority of commentators, who believe that the succession to the Speaker of the House is unconstitutional because they read the authorizing provision in the Constitution, which says that Congress can declare what officer shall act as president. They read that provision to refer only to an executive branch officer, in which case, if that's right, Congress would not have the power in the succession statute of 1947 to actually have Nancy Pelosi succeed, or I should say, act as president of the United States. So the reason that's a problem is because, as I said, the majority of commentators have suggested or argued that the succession statute is unconstitutional. So you could have a situation where, and then who decides that question? You could have a situation where, say, the Attorney General determines that the succession statute is unconstitutional and declares that Secretary of State, who's next in line under the succession statute and who's in the executive branch, that the Secretary of State will act as president. You could have Nancy Pelosi claim that she, under the succession statute, is the acting as president. She could, in that capacity, for example, fire Barr. And it's just not at all clear how we would, as a nation, if in fact Barr gave that reading to the succession statute, and if the executive branch viewed it as unconstitutional, it's not at all clear how you sort that, the dual claims to the presidency or to act as president, how you sort that out.
All right, let's game that situation out a little bit. So Mike Pence goes out on the campaign trail this week. He is surrounded by aides who have, yes, been tested a few times, but turns out that testing regime is not adequate. A week from now, 2 weeks from now, he comes down with the coronavirus. Trump gets worse. And so you have this period of time where, A, it's not clear which of them is capable of running the government in the short term, and B, it is not clear that either of them is going to survive in the longer term. You know, this is an issue you didn't address in your piece. And we are in real time conducting an election in which they are the two people on the ballot. So Nancy Pelosi says, I think I'm acting president. And from both of their bed chambers, they croak, no, you're not. And Mike Pompeo says, you're not president. You're not acting president. But if anybody's acting president, it's actually me. So game it out. What happens at that point?
So that's a harder question than if both Pence and Trump are dead, but I'll answer it. That's a harder question because, which I've never really thought about, but I assume it'll be a question about who has the authority to determine whether the president and vice president are unable to carry out the office. And David, you should jump in here, but I'm guessing that since the 25th Amendment specifies a process for determining that, that if that process is not followed, I don't think that Pelosi could come in and basically determine on her own that the president is unable to carry out the functions of the office. We actually have a constitutional process for determining that now. I don't think it extends to the vice president.
That is correct.
So in that situation, I think she would be on weaker ground. Although, you know, maybe they are disabled, but there's a process for determining that, and it doesn't include her. She has a stronger claim to act as president if they both die.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, Jack. The 25th Amendment applies to the president and to the vice president, who can assume the powers and duties as acting president in the case of a disability. It is easier for that mechanism if the president dies, because then the vice president becomes president and the vice presidency is vacant. Now, if the vice president who is becoming president is also very ill, here is what I would imagine would happen. Even in these hyper-partisan times, I would imagine that Congress would immediately convene. They would ask for a nomination from Mike Pence for the vacancy of the vice presidency and would immediately vote yes or no on that nominee under the terms of the 25th Amendment. That process has only happened once, and that was when Gerald Ford assumed the presidency and Nelson Rockefeller followed the procedures in the 25th Amendment to become vice president. And it was treated with some urgency, but not immediate urgency, because Gerald Ford was a healthy man and there was no indication that he was going anywhere. In a case like this, rather than have the potential for two competing centers of power, a Pompeo camp and a Pelosi camp, or even a Chuck Grassley camp as Senate pro tem, I would think that everybody would get together and say, Mr. Pence, now Mr. President Pence, as soon as you can, give us a reasonable name. We will vote on it within hours so that we actually have a vice president who is in that constitutional order and avoids this issue at all.
Can I just introduce a note of doubt on that? I agree with what you just said, except I'm just not so sure about the part about even given our politics, the nation would come together to do that. I mean, if we're talking about, and again, this is an extremely morbid conversation, but we're trying to figure out what the law requires. If we're talking about a situation where Pelosi could act as president, and if the Supreme Court nomination is still on the line, those stakes are hugely high. It's conceivable that she could, for example, withdraw the nomination or not confirm the nomination after the Senate consents to it. And given everything else we know about norms and the hugely high stakes of that disagreement, I would hope that there would be a quick confirmation of a vice president pursuant to the 25th Amendment. I'm not sure.
All right. So, Jack, what is the right answer to this question? I mean, it's like an ultimate nightmare scenario to have in the context of an ongoing presidential election, a dispute about who is president as a result of the deaths of both the president and the vice president in a global pandemic. What's the right answer here?
So I don't think there is a clear answer under the Constitution. I think that the reason there's debate about this is because the Constitution uses the term officer in several ways. And if anything, I just don't think that there's a definitive answer under the Constitution itself. But the reason I think that the right answer is that the Speaker can act as president despite the constitutional concerns, and this is my view of how the Constitution should be interpreted, not everyone would share this view, is this law has been on the books since 1947. There have been expectations that have built around it. The first succession statute like this was in 1792. And there, even though it was informed by politics as much as law, the 1792 Congress provided that the Speaker and President Pro Tem could, actually the order was flipped, I think, could succeed the Vice President. So, my view is that there's been a settlement of this issue through the constitutional practice of the branches. It went back in the 1880s. We went back to succession within the executive branch, and then in 1947, Truman wanted to have succession go to be more democratic, as he put it, so he wanted it to go to the House. And very importantly, so I just think that there's kind of a settled understanding, whether it's the right or wrong answer to the question as an original matter. I think there's been a settled understanding in practice. And very importantly, there's an attorney general opinion. It was only an acting attorney general opinion. And it wasn't much, didn't have much analysis, but the attorney general of the United States in 1947 concluded that the 1947 statute was constitutional, that there could be succession to the House of Representatives, to the Speaker of the House, consistent with the Constitution. So, I mean, if I'm Attorney General, absent something else I haven't seen, I just think that's the has to be the right answer. But I'm not confident that that's what this Attorney General will do.
Yeah, so I just want to say, if you were the Attorney General, I think a lot of things would have happened differently over the last 18 months. Which okay. brings me
okay.
which brings me to Quinta. So Quinta, I want to posit a prudential circumstance for you and have you reflect on it. It seems to me that the idea of the constitutional clash that Jack is describing is so horrible in the context of our already horribly divided politics and so unpredictable and explosive that it is almost unbelievable that Mike Pence, in the face of that possibility, with the president already in the hospital, is going out on the campaign trail. Leave aside whether he should be in Washington for purposes of managing the situation, it seems to me he should be hidden in a hermetically sealed container in order to prevent exactly the situation that Jack described. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I would certainly say that Pence does not appear to be treating the circumstance in the way that one might hope. The same, by the way, goes for Bill Barr, who's farther down the line of succession, but was at the Rose Garden ceremony and apparently is choosing not to self-isolate, which is, I think, sort of representative of the general approach that the administration is taking. Look, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that Pence is behaving in this way. I mean, I think that sort of, it's impossible to know for a certainty how the virus got into the White House in this way, but it's certain, I'm sure it did not help that it seems that there was not mask wearing in the White House. There was largely not social distancing. For all the fanfare about the amount of testing that the White House was doing, it perhaps wasn't as much or of the kinds of tests that one would want. And so Pence continuing to go out on the campaign trail even after this has taken place, I think is really a symptom of the same sort of state of mind that the White House has gone through this whole thing, which may have put them in that position to begin with. I'll also say, I mean, just to be completely fair, the White House's approach to this is obviously the most important on a national level. I will note that a number of doctors and epidemiologists have argued that Biden should also not be on the campaign trail until a full 14 days after the debate. And at least the last thing that I saw, my impression was that his campaign does intend to have him travel. It's also true that the last I saw, the vice presidential debates are still on, which would put Mike Pence and Kamala Harris in the same room, albeit at a distance. I know the Biden campaign has been pressing for further distance between the vice presidential candidates, but that frankly seems absolutely insane to me that you would even go so far as to risk that. So I think the real burden here falls on the White House's shoulders, given that it is, after all, the White House. But it is also true that the other sort of campaign apparatuses seem to perhaps not be treating this with the level of gravity that it deserves.
What do you think, David? Are Quinta and I being fair here, or is it just unreasonable to expect Mike Pence in the last 30 days of an election that he and the president are, you know, don't seem on a track to win, with the president in the hospital, to not be out there trying to run the train for them? Is it just unreasonable to expect that under those circumstances, or is it reasonable to take the view that, hey, the circumstance Jack outlines here is so dire mm-hmm. that the vice president really needs to avoid that at all costs.
The responsible thing to do on all of those fronts would be not to go out and campaign in person. I don't think that's the primary driver here, but there's also a weird calculation going on. I'm not convinced, based on what I've seen politically, that Mike Pence going somewhere and holding a rally is going to gain many Republican votes. Donald Trump, for all of his faults, does have the ability to rile up a crowd and to get them feeling passionate and to, in political science terms, drive the base and get them to turn out at the polls. Mike Pence is not that person. And I'm not sure what the real advantage of him going out and campaigning is. Regarding the debate, it's just interesting to me that in this very unusual year, one thing that many Americans have learned to do quite adequately is use Zoom and other technologies that allow you to hold meetings virtually. Even Congress has held virtual hearings. There is absolutely no reason, especially after seeing the debacle that was the presidential debate, why the vice presidential debate should not immediately move to a virtual format. Because listen,
Lawfare can host it.
And we would love to. We can make an offer to the Debates Commission and see if they're willing to turn on a dime. Chances are they won't. And we'll be stuck with an event that, frankly, wasn't going to be like a debate anyway. Part of the thing that happens in a presidential debate is you feed off the crowd and you get the crowd reactions. Even if they're told to be quiet, they're never completely quiet. Well, that's not happening in these debates anyway. You're not getting the full audience in the same way. If you're already losing that, what more do you lose just because the candidates who are 6 or 8 or 12 feet apart can't see each other and react to each other's body language? I guess that's useful for people to see at a very small level. But given the stakes, I think it's unconscionable that both candidates have not already said, we will be happy to do a publicly viewed, full moderated event online, but there's no reason for us to be in person and put ourselves or anyone else at risk.
What do you think, Jack? Is it reasonable, given the severity of the situation you describe, to expect Pence to insulate himself from COVID risk, or is it just all bets are off in the last 30 days of a campaign?
I mean, it depends on what you're trying to, which values you're trying to maximize. It's obviously hugely important for the country that he not fall ill and that raise this and this problem arise, depending, of course, on the president's health over the next several days and week. But, you know, they think that the future of the presidency is a very important thing, too. And they're making, you know, they're making the judgment. It's not the judgment that I would make, but I'm obviously not a politician.
Yeah, that's true. So, David, your piece reminded me of what I think is the most extreme and outrageous example of presidential health cover-ups, which involved a yacht and a jaw surgery, which I'll let you describe. In the post-25th Amendment world, in which a presidential incapacity would involve turning things over in an orderly fashion, or could involve an orderly fashion, to Mike Pence, how similarly wild and woolly could something get?
Yeah, that case is one of those where, even as a politically interested kid growing up, reading a lot of history, somehow I'd never heard the story of Grover Cleveland having a tumor discovered on the roof of his mouth, not wanting the public to know that he had cancer, because cancer could not be spoken of publicly in those times. It was the disease that shall not be named. So he decided, during a time of the scare of 1893, an economic downturn that was quite bad, that it would roil the markets and the economy to have it known that the president had this dread disease. So rather than tell the public about it, he went out on a yacht and said he was going for summer vacation up to the Northeast. And they did the surgery on the boat below decks with the president strapped to a chair, which in turn was strapped to one of the masts. And a very small team of doctors performed the surgery and ended up removing quite a bit of his jaw and his mouth in the process. Incredibly risky operation. Luckily, the seas were calm, because movements would have obviously made it much more difficult. What's shocking about this is that the president's people actually kept up the deception for quite some time, even afterwards. They vilified the reporter who got wind of the story from a loose-lipped dentist who had been on the medical team. And it was only after Cleveland's death of unrelated causes years later that the story came out. Now, part of the reason for this was a dynamic that is different in the post-25th Amendment world, and part of it is not. The part that's not is the fact that the president thought if people knew I was sick or I was having this surgery, then they, you know, would lose faith in the government or the economy would get hurt or something like that. Well, that could still be true even in a post-25th Amendment world. You can imagine certainly a president like Trump thinking, you know, the country can't get by without me. And so I can't possibly be disabled or be seen as disabled for any period of time if this disease he has does get worse. The part that's different, of course, is Grover Cleveland could not temporarily hand over power to his vice president, who I believe at the time was Adlai Stevenson, and get it back. There was no mechanism for the vice president to do anything but become president by the precedent that John Tyler had set years before. So, in fact, it certainly looked like the dynamic there was a little bit different. I'm not sure how that would play out now. Vice presidents have no interest in looking like they're usurping the power of the president. So you posit a scenario where Trump gets a little bit worse, where perhaps even the doctors have to admit that he's not able to perform basic functions of the office. The urge to invoke the 25th Amendment, even against the president's will, becomes stronger. Pence certainly doesn't seem like the person to do it. If there's any person in modern history who certainly doesn't want to upset the president that he was elected with, it sure looks like Mike Pence. But if it were to happen, it's the kind of thing that the president and vice president probably shouldn't fear, because the invocations of Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, and there have been three of them, when Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush respectively went in for surgeries, they temporarily handed power to George H.W. Bush in Reagan's case, and twice to Dick Cheney in George W. Bush's case. And things went fine. It was a matter of hours rather than days or longer in both cases, but it showed that the system actually works, and power was transferred back as soon as the president was able to take on the powers and duties of the office again. So you look at this and you say, maybe they should be a little more inclined, if the president's condition gets worse, to actually consider a temporary transfer of power. If nothing else, even in an election season, it makes it look like they are responsibly following the mechanisms of government that were set up for exactly a scenario like this, which oddly could help them in the election campaign more than hurt them.
We're going to leave it there. Jack Goldsmith, David Priest, Quinta Jurassic, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode, working on a Sunday, is Zachary Frank of the redoubtable Goat Rodeo firm. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. You can buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com, and we need you to go to thelawfarestore.com and buy that merch. We also need you to rate us and review us wherever you found us, and to share us on all the social media services you use. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one and only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.